So welcome to this session of the Futures Foundation Futures Forum. There are a group of us physically present who are enjoying the ambience of a Randstad conference room and some excellent refreshments. And I'd like to acknowledge the presence of Steve Shepherd from Randstad, who's our host and without whom this forum wouldn't be taking place. I hope that those of you listening to this session via podcast are in similarly convivial surroundings and that you enjoy the program. The format for the session is simple. In a moment, I'll introduce our guest, Jeff Davies. Those of us here will listen to Jeff for about 45 minutes, perhaps, after which the recording will cease, and we'll engage in a conversation between Jeff and ourselves about his thoughts and ideas. I hope that those listening via podcast will also use this recording to stimulate discussions amongst your friends and colleagues, because that's the reason these forums exist, to explore ideas about what would make Australia a better place. Today's focus is on economics, or more precisely, new ways to think about economics. Jeff Davies is a senior research fellow from the Australian National University in Canberra. Originally trained as a geophysicist and only retired from the university a few years ago, but first came to our attention as the author in 2004 of this book, Economia, New Economic Systems to Empower People and Support the Living World. And more recently of Sack the Economists and Disband Their Departments, copies of which Jeff has brought along for anyone who wants them today. Jeff's topic tonight is the role of reformed economics in creating Australia's future. Please join me in welcoming Jeff.
Thank you, Charles, and Steve, and others for being here. Well, since Charles introduced my new book, Sack the Economists and Disband Their Department, I'll say just a word about that. In specifics, a lot of what I'll talk about is from that or relates to it, but yes, it's a confronting title. And the reason is that there are a lot of frustrated actual economists, plus people like me looking at economics, who think that there was a monumental failure a few years back when the profession, the mainstream profession, largely failed to see the approaching global financial crisis. In the sciences that I have worked in, if you get a contradiction to your theories like that, you abandon your theories and you lose prestige and you might lose your job or something. But no such thing has happened to the mainstream economics profession. It clings to power. And I've read commentators tearing their hair, saying, "What's the matter with these people?" So I thought, well, it's time. I think maybe we've been too subtle. We need to spell out exactly what the message is. So I thought, well, that would be a good title, and then I could write to that title. So I rearranged all my ideas from two previous books into a small package. The reason that I have done this and used this confronting title is that as a scientist, I think the main theory of mainstream economics has nothing to do with real world modern economies and is quite misleading. And I'll say up front, no, I'm not a socialist. No, it doesn't lead me to socialism. I'll explain what I think we can do that would be better than things we've done in the past. So that leads me into the topic, the role of transformed economics in creating Australia's future, and I want to start with a couple of basic questions. What is an economy? Well, to me, it's the way we make a society makes its living collectively, or in the aggregate. It's how we acquire the material means of survival. What's an economy for? Well, it is to support the kind of society we choose to live in and to support everyone within that society. Now, having thought about that question, that's my answer. And you'll notice that I put economy subservient to society. I think for too long the economic system has dominated society and told us what kind of society we will have, and I think it's a very unhealthy one. And it doesn't support everyone within the society or in the world, not the way we could have people supported. So I'll explain why I'm saying these things, but I thought to get the message out so I don't lose track of where this is going, or so you can get a notion of where this is going, I would say, what is the prospect if we act on the things that I'll speak about? I'll speak about what I regard as a series of quite fundamental flaws in mainstream economic thinking, not just the theory, but other things that are really wrong. And if we fix those, what might we get? Well, I think we would get markets to work properly, and I mean by that markets to work the way they're claimed to work, but I think they're very far from that. Economists admit market failures in some circumstances, but I think market failures are widespread. And a good example of a market failure is pollution. Pollution can be dumped out in the world. The producer doesn't have to bear the full cost of the waste that just goes out into the world and maybe gets cleaned up or just maybe degrades the world and people's lives. For a market to function properly, producers have to bear full costs. Otherwise, the market signal back to the producer is distorted or weakened. It's quite fundamental thinking about markets. Once we get that idea, the next thing we might do is guide markets via incentives so they work for us. So first of all, get them working properly and then say, well, what are they accomplishing? And I will explain why I think markets at present do not do things that are good for us, despite all the rhetoric and all the theoretical claims that free markets are best and will do the best of all possible worlds. I think we can stabilize our economies. We've had a big global financial crash and a continuing depression in some parts of the world. And there have been financial crises back through history. The dot-com crash, the Asian currency meltdown, the 87 stock market crash, the Great Depression in the 30s, the Great Depression in the 1890s, and a string of financial crashes back earlier in history. So that kind of instability is part of modern economies, and a key bit reason for it is the amount of debt that gets created. I think we can extend democracy to workplaces and even to the economy as a whole. I think we can create economies that serve us and nurture us. And by that I mean people in all our wholeness and complexity, not just our material needs, but our communities, our society, our emotional health, our spiritual welfare, if you like, as well. And I think we can have economies that return us to our place within the biosphere. Every other species on the planet lives in its niche in the biosphere. Everything is interconnected. We're the only species that spoils our nest. We're trashing our life support system. We can't continue to live this way. It's not a greenie's position or anything. It's a simple fact of life on this planet. If the species is to survive and prosper, it needs to live within the biosphere, because even though we might, and here we are in a tall building in the middle of a large city, we might not realise how connected we are, but everything we eat, all the water we drink, all the air we breathe, cycles through the biosphere and comes back to us to nurture us and support us. And as we degrade the biosphere, we degrade ourselves. And if we kill it, we kill ourselves. It's really very simple. So, how do we get to... Oh, and yes, and we'll have peace and love forevermore. And no, I don't believe that. This is not about utopia. This is about doing better than we have been doing, and I maintain that's not a very big ask. The 20th century, we had two major world wars that killed tens of millions of people. We had a huge depression. We were on the brink of nuclear annihilation. The 19th century, we had dark satanic mills and child labour and lots of pollution and classes and all that. So I don't think we've been doing that well, and I think to do better is not a very big ask. The question is how, and I think there's a path before us once we recognise certain things about what we're doing these days. Why did the mainstream economics profession not foresee the global financial crisis? There were people who did, and they made credible warnings, but the people in major policy said, no, things are... One phrase was, the outlook continues to be benign, or something like that, even as in 2007, as things were starting to collapse. Why were they so blinded to what was starting to happen? I think there are two fundamental reasons. One is that the macroeconomic models, the computer models that try to track the whole economy and where it's going, do not include money and debt. I'll come back to that. And the other reason why they didn't see this coming was they think that economies are never far from equilibrium. Why? Well, because the main theory of free markets says that the free markets will bring the economy to an equilibrium, and if it gets disturbed, the markets will bring it back. So it's like a gently rocking chair or a rocking horse. Well, I've already mentioned symptoms of lack of equilibrium. A financial crash, there's no way you can portray that as anything but disequilibrium. Free fall is a term they use. So lack of equilibrium is obvious there, but it's also... When Henry Ford got his assembly line going and started undercutting his rivals and sold a lot of cars, and then he cut his price because he'd sold so many and sold a lot more, he got a virtuous circle going for him. His enterprise grew exponentially until he dominated half the market, at least in the US. When Bill Gates got his software going, similar thing. His place in the market grew exponentially. Well, and why? Because of economies of scale and another thing called lock-in. Once you get your technology established, it's hard for another one to displace it. The result is this exponential growth, which means a percentage growth every year, year after year, and after some years things get very large. That is a signature of instability to a physicist and to an engineer. Something that increases, the bigger it gets, the faster it grows, that's an instability. I would say, just citing a couple of other things, the rich get richer. Well, they do. People debate whether the poor get poorer. I think lately, and in many places, the poor have got poorer. But the rich getting richer, to me, I think about this, there's a distribution of income in the society And the peaks get higher and higher as the billionaires get more and more. That's an instability. That's things going to more and more extremes. So thinking as a scientist or an engineer, that's what I see when I look at modern economies. So I don't think the theory is correct that predicts that economies come to equilibrium or that free markets bring economies to equilibrium. And I can cite, I think, even better reasons for saying this, and that is to look at the assumptions that this theory is built upon. It's a theory that was developed late in the 19th century, modelled after some physics, which was how some things come to an equilibrium. And they said, I mean, it was a good thing to try. Well, let's try modelling people and economics this way. And it predicted this equilibrium, and the economists fell in love with it, and then they became infatuated with it, and then they became obsessed with it and wanted it to be always true, and they've tried for many years to save the general equilibrium, because there was a corollary, a spin-off from this theory. It said not just that there'll be an equilibrium, but it's the most efficient state for the economy to be in of all possible states. The greatest output for the least input. Well, it's a lovely theory and an enticing result. To get it, you have to make some assumptions as you develop your theory. You base it on assumptions. Here's some examples. We can all of us predict the future. Well, not strictly speaking. We can assign reliable probabilities to all the contingencies that might happen. I'm not very good at that myself, but anyway. They assume, they've discovered that you have to assume that if you want this equilibrium result to happen, to come out of the theory. You actually need infinite computing power at your disposal, each one of us. There should be no social interactions interfering with the one-on-one transactions. So, no fashion, no fads, no stampeding herds in the stock market, no people doing something because other people are doing it already, and they want to fit in, or they think that George Soros must be onto something, so they'll do it too, or whatever. No irrationality, what they call irrational. You know, we're human creatures. We're prone to our passions. It's a wonderful part of our lives. Our passions can be manipulated with ridiculous ease. So no, we don't sit back and compute what is the most practical clothing I will wear, purchase and wear. Julia here, I think, is even less likely than the blokes who are most of us sitting around this table. Women, the idea of purchasing, making a rational choice of practical, functional clothing, no, they choose fashionable clothing and we love it. So, you know, it's just not the way the world works. You get the idea. Oh, and I've mentioned economies of scale. You have to assume there are no economies of scale, so there'll be no Henry Fords and no Bill Gateses. Well, but there are Henry Ford and Bill Gates and a lot of other big firms who grow and dominate the world. There are many market segments in which there are three or four or five global corporations accounting for more than half the market segment. They're enormous. So economies of scale are a pervasive feature, actually, and they come amazingly pervasively. They come out of learning curves, out of experience, learning how to do things better. It's not just in technology, it's in all kinds of activities. So what's my point? My point is there are the assumptions that you need to make to get this theory of free markets to predict equilibrium and optimality. They're ridiculous assumptions. The world isn't like that at all. And here's the kicker. If you change any one of the assumptions I've made, let alone all of them, you predict instability. You predict, well, look at a modern economy. There's new technologies bubbling up all the time, new firms exploiting them. Whoever gets in first within the new segment, they can trump everybody else. That's how Bill Gates got his fortune. He got in early, he played it smart, and he stayed on top. And whole segments of the economy get shoved aside and shrivel away, and new ones bubble up. It's not chaotic, but it's changing all the time. Sometimes erratically, sometimes big and dramatic changes. A lot of the time, small changes. Well, physicists and systems theorists and engineers know about this kind of system. It's not a chaotic system, but it's a complex system, something in which there are feedbacks that drive some things to grow until they hit some limits, and then they level off, and other feedbacks that do actually stabilize things and so on. This kind of thing is known outside of economics. A complex system is a far from equilibrium system. It's called a self-organizing system. So it's nowhere near the general equilibrium that the standard theory uses. The standard theory is not even a useful place to begin. It's not a good first approximation, as we scientists say. In fact, it's a radically different beast that you're dealing with. And the book that I didn't actually publish, but I put available on my website, is called The Nature of the Beast. We have misidentified the nature of the beast we're dealing with. If you think you're dealing with a rocking chair, or a rocking horse, say, if you push it, it rocks a bit and comes back to its equilibrium position. But in fact, you're dealing with a wild horse or a team of wild horses, then you're not going to manage them very well. And my analogy is a team of wild horses. My conclusion from looking at the evidence for the system being this kind of self-organizing, always unstable system is this. Clearly, markets are powerful. They accomplish a lot. They allow us to organize and develop things, generate goods, sell them, generate services, sell them. People get what they want. We get many things this way without anybody having to be sitting up top planning everything. So they're very powerful in the information processing sense, of processing all the things we want to do and having having coherent outcomes. So they're powerful in that sense. Yet we have too much pollution. We're using up renewable and non-renewable sources. The planet around us is in crisis. You know, I get my science magazine and every second article is about dwindling species and habitats, and we're doing awful things to the environment that supports us. There's extremely rich and there's many poor, and I think I look at that and I see that many people are not getting rewarded in proportion to their contribution. And I can give you a list. There's a list in the new book of at least seven mechanisms that work in modern economies to pump wealth from the rest of us to the already wealthy. These are identifiable mechanisms. You know, it's one well-known one is that if you've got some assets, you can get a loan. If you're poor, you can't. You don't have a proper job. charging interest on money created out of nothing. You know, things that are well known, but you list them up and you say, well, actually, I don't think everybody's getting a fair share. and we used to get more of it. Now, the mainstream, well, I guess I'll use the term mainstream people. Some of them complain about wealth transfer programs, and what they're referring to is government programs to tax the rich and help the poor and things like that. But these are wealth transfer mechanisms, and they pump the other way. So I've been talking about the kind of system that I think a modern economy is, and I think it's a very different one. And I started to say that markets are clearly powerful, so what do we do if they're malfunctioning? Do we have to give up on markets and become socialists and try to plan everything? Well, I don't think that'll work either, because this bubbling, changing, complex system that is a modern economy is too much like a living beast to try to constrain that way. You can't. It's not appropriate either. So I don't think either socialism or old capitalism are good ways to run an economy. So what do we do? Well, if markets are powerful, what do they respond to? They respond to where the profit is. Unfortunately, at present, it's too easy to increase your profit by exploiting people and trashing the earth. And so guess what's happening a lot? However, there's a lot of perverse subsidies and perverse incentives operating in our modern economy. Why do Australian taxpayers fork out something like $10 billion a year to support mining, including fossil fuel mining, when that fossil fuel burning harms the planet anyway? Why aren't we putting those billions into developing clean fuels? So if we did that, the miners wouldn't go broke, you can be sure of that, but at least not for a while, but our efforts would be better directed to a more positive future. And that's really my point. If somebody's polluting, it's already a recognised idea in economics that if you put a tax that, internalises the cost to discourage the pollution, then that can encourage better behaviour. So we do that already. So I'm not talking about anything that's radically new. I'm saying we can, using sensibly, carefully, taxes, penalties and incentives, subsidies if you like, but there are many kinds of incentive you can introduce, to nudge things in better directions or more powerfully move them in better directions. All I'm suggesting is we can do that more coherently and without guilt. Because the theory that says you shouldn't interfere with the markets, I'm saying, is a nonsense theory. It's rubbish. I speak as a scientist. In fact, I can only call it pseudoscience. It's dressed up in a lot of mathematics and a lot of jargon, but I've explained to you the assumptions and why I think it, you know, we don't have equilibrium. Now, this is a novel thing to say, a confronting thing to say, but I think it's the simple truth. To a scientist, I think it's pathetically easy to point out that economies aren't like that. Okay. So that's a lot of why I think we can do better in the future, have an economy that is better at supporting our society and giving us an indefinite future instead of a foreshortened, threatened one. But there are other things. One of them is national accounting. Now, this has got nothing to do with the kind of theory and stuff I've been talking about. It's a completely separate aspect. What is the measure of economic success? Almost everywhere in the world these days. It's an increasing GDP, gross domestic product. when the Treasurer stands up and says the economy has grown, if you translate the term the economy, he means the GDP has grown. What is the GDP? It's the sum, effectively, of all the activity we do that involves money, that we buy and sell. Now, you don't double count if there's a chain of things in a production chain, but, you know, they do that. It's all right. That's all taken care of. Essentially, it measures the activity that involves money, that's part of the money economy. If I have a chemical company that's makes $3 million, sells $3 million of chemicals in a year, but creates pollution, and that pollution costs $1 million to clear up, how much better off are we? Well, I think the arithmetic's obvious. 3 million minus the million to clean up the mess, $2 million. How does it count in the GDP? It's all activity. $3 million to produce, $1 million to clean up, it's just another kind of activity, add it. $4 million, the GDP goes up. Ralph Nader, a very long time ago, said every time there's a car crash, the GDP goes up. Why? Because you have to replace it or repair it. If somebody gets injured, that's even better. You have to take care of them. You know, there's some cynical thing. The best person in the economy is the one who's going through an expensive divorce, who's crashed his car, who's got cancer, who's doing all these expensive things. Because, you know, I'll confess, we don't live in Canberra, by the way, but we used to. And Canberra's a lovely place, and I won't bear any of the usual cliches about it. And the fires roared into it back in 2003, 500 houses. Well, it boosted the local economy because they had to be fixed and rebuilt. It's crazy. It's an insane way. It had its use when it was invented, pre-World War II, and it came to prominence then because the US government used it to measure the total war effort of the economy. And they were directing what happened in the economy very explicitly. Then it made sense. It measured, well, it was a fairly good measure, not a perfect measure. But afterwards, people kept using it. But if you stop and look at it, it's a stupid way to measure our standard of life, well-being, quality of life. Come back to my definition of an economy. What's it for? I think it's not just to keep us all active, busy, frenetic. It's actually to make us better off. What does that mean? Well, I think that's for us to decide for ourselves and to choose. Do we want to work 60 hours a week? Well, I don't. do we want to spend time with our kids? Do we want to have a healthy community and a nice footy club and whatever? I think we want all those things. Now, up until about the 70s, we were getting most of those things. I think things changed around that time, and we've been losing them again, and working too hard, or not working at all because there's not enough jobs. So there are better ways of doing the national accounting. What you need is a balance sheet. $3 million of chemicals in the credit column, $1 million clean up in the debit column. Add up columns, subtract the debits from the credits, you get a net, you find out how much better off you are. That makes sense. That's defensible. It might be hard to measure some of the things, but it's a defensible approach. Putting everything in the credit column and adding it up is not a defensible way to measure our well-being. It's crazy. Now, I occasionally talk to real economists and they say, oh, well, yes, well, we know that, and it was, you know, blah-de-blah, it was invented by Kuznets and whatever. But I do not hear a chorus of economists all the time telling the Treasurer to stop using the GDP. So I hold the profession substantially responsible for not giving us a better measure. They exist. There's something called the genuine progress indicator. It tries to measure all sorts of things and end up with one number. Well, it would be better to do that because at least it subtracts bad things. And then there are people who say we need triple bottom line. Well, there are people who do it. Material, social, environmental. Assess each of them separately. And then there are people who say, well, we need to separate stocks from flows, assets from income. Assets is how wealthy you are now. Liabilities is how much you owe. The difference is your net wealth. Income and cost is how much they change over the year. You know, accountants understand all this. No big mystery, but we don't do it. Well, some people try it. These measures are developed, but they're not the dominant measures we use. They need to be, because it grossly distorts our priorities to use this GDP. What does the Treasurer want to be able to do when he stands up for the budget speech? He wants to be able to say the economy has grown. He means the GDP. Cleaning up the pollution helped to grow the GDP. So he's not going to complain about that. There's an unholy alliance between polluters and politicians, I'm afraid. Unscrupulous, less than scrupulous politicians. If we go and chop down all the Tasmanian forest, the GDP will go up, all that activity, all those products sold. We'll lose natural assets. We won't be able to keep harvesting forest even. So we'll lose the lumber supply if we cut it down too fast. Unless you count assets as well as what you're taking, your flows in and out, you're not properly assessing what you're doing. So I think this is another way in which mainstream thinking allows our lives to be seriously distorted, our priorities in our society to be seriously distorted. I need to mention a few other things because I've mentioned theories about economies, I've mentioned national accounting. financial markets, I've got to mention them. You can look at how much financial market trading there was before the financial liberalisations of the 70s and 80s. And it was a lot less than, you know, it turns over. Now I don't have the numbers in my head, but astonishing billions and trillions of dollars. You can look at how often, if you're an investor, you might want to shift your investment. Well, the fortunes of companies go up and down, but most companies don't change their fortunes that much over the course of a year. So will it change more than 20% on average? I don't think so. You can say, well, therefore, if I have a portfolio, I only want to might only want to shift 20% of it in a year, and maybe that's a lot. If the objective of the financial markets is the allocation of investment to efficient uses, which is the theory, which is the myth. So if you use, you know, I'm a scientist, I do back-of-the-envelope estimates. Does this make sense? And I've mentioned to you two ways of estimating how much activity there ought to be in the financial markets. One looking back in the 60s and one just looking at what you might do. Both of them get you to this conclusion. The financial markets are trading about 50 times faster than they need to. They can turn over hundreds of millions of dollars in a morning. They turn over the equivalent of all the tradable assets in the world in a matter of weeks. We don't need them to be trading that frenetically. Why are they doing it? Because most of what they do is not about the allocation of investment to efficient use. It's about speculation and arbitrage. Arbitrage is where something is a little bit cheaper here than it is over there, so you buy it in the cheap market and sell it in the... And sometimes the two are only milliseconds apart. So it's skimming. And the economists say, oh, well, it helps to keep things in equilibrium. Well, no, it does not. And the speculation helps to drive bubbles up and then crashes down. They both destabilise. So they are parasitic. Only 2%. If they're trading 50 times more often than they need to, then 1 in 50 trades is useful and 49 are not. So maybe only 2% of trades are useful. The rest of them are skimming, and they're skimming huge amounts of wealth from the productive real economy, not just the money shuffling. Worse than that, they drive booms and they drive crashes. They destabilise. The markets fluctuate erratically, crazily, all the time. They don't need to keep changing like that. So they destabilise, they make it harder to manage. If you're managing a firm, you've got to manage not only for next quarterly bottom line for the shareholders, but you've got to hedge against your market capitalisation suddenly dropping, or the Aussie dollar suddenly leaping up or leaping or dropping down. Got to hedge. You can't optimise very well at all for medium-term wealth generation. In a more stable climate, you could better optimise your strategies. And of course, every now and then there's a huge crash, and that causes immense damage to business and to people's lives, and just unconscionable. If it's avoidable, which I think it is. How do you avoid it? Well, the idea's been around for many decades. A man called Tobin, an economist, said, charge a tax on all the financial transactions. It doesn't have to be very big. The differences they're trading on are quite small, less than 1%, maybe even a tiny fraction of 1% in the currency markets. Take the profit out of the skimmers, the speculators, and you eliminate a lot of the frenetic activity, bring them back to what they're supposed to be doing, servicing the real economy. Financial sector should only be a few percent of the economy, and it should be serving the economy, but now it dominates it. So if we do that, we can stabilise, do a lot about stabilising the economy. Land is not properly conceived. It's conceived as a commodity, and as another commodity. But land isn't another commodity. You can't manufacture land. If there's a demand for it, you can't make more. You can charge more for it. And the banking system, I'm afraid, is silly enough that you get into this spiral where property price goes up. Well, somebody gets a big loan. They come along and they bid the price of a property up. That lifts the prices of all like properties. And then somebody else says, oh, well, now, you know, I've got all this equity, goes to the bank, I want a loan on this. And you get a spiral driving prices up. Now, it sounds simplistic, but I think that's the essence of what's been happening and what happened in the US mortgage market that was the most immediate trigger for the financial crash. If you look at, you know, it's now worth more, so now I can get a bigger loan, and that'll make it worth even more. Now I can get an even bigger loan. It's a pyramid scheme. It's not about real values. Some people talk about a Ponzi scheme. Ponzi was a famous con artist, supposedly investing, getting investment money, but he was using this lot of investment money to pay off the last lot and not actually doing anything useful. Bernie Madoff got into that game and, you know, it doesn't last. He came to grief. You must come to grief because you're running a pyramid scheme. But the whole economy got into that and it came to grief. So we need to treat land sensibly, and there's a bloke in Sydney called Shan Turnbull, who's one person who's thought a lot about this and said, well, you could have a community land trust that owns the land and if indeed the price, the worth of land goes up because of proximity of all the businesses, and here we are in the middle of a lot of businesses and activity, so this land is considered to be worth a lot. Who does that belong to, that wealth, that extra worth? I think it actually belongs to the community that's here because it arises from the proximity of all the things that are here, the businesses, the people who can work in them, the train station down there, the tram system, the whole transport system, etc. Each one of them contributes, but the value of the land rises, you know, if you buy a bit, you can get rich, but you don't have to do anything. You just wait for everybody else to invest around you. So you get a windfall profit. Well, I think that windfall properly belongs to the community as a collective. Well, there's a naughty word, collective. Community. It's a good word. You can keep the wealth for the community. Well, there's an example of the London, they extended the London tube system, I guess it was, train system anyway. They spent huge amounts of taxpayers' dollars building the thing, billions of dollars. I forget the numbers, $3 billion. And property values went up $13 billion along the new line. Most of that was captured by landlords and speculators. Somebody tried to get it financed by saying, well, we're going to gain that, so we'll use that potential gain to fund it, and you can do that. And in fact, when they set up Canberra, some people tried to set up Canberra that way, but it wasn't done properly and it all fell apart. But these things have been done and they can be done. And if you keep your land price spiral from happening, then our kids can afford to buy their first home because it now costs three or four or more times in terms of salary fraction what it used to when I was younger. ownership, just briefly. If you own, then profit, reward comes to you, benefit comes to you. At present, ownership is very unevenly distributed. Some people own a lot, many people don't own much. It's another one of these instabilities. But there are many forms of ownership we have already. We don't just have to have big corporations and small businesses and struggling battlers trying to pay off their mortgage. You can have cooperatives, there are plenty of those. You can have enterprises owned by an enterprise owned by its employees. There is a surprising number of those. A lot of them are in the US. Somebody got Congress to pass a thing, what are they called? ESOPs, Employment Stock Ownership Programs or something, that would help employees to buy the company they work for. Visa, I think, is one of those. United Airlines is owned by its pilots, I'm told. And there are thousands of them in the heart of capitalist America. So if the workers own the factory, then the big conflicts of the last two centuries are gone. Bosses versus workers, well, the workers are the bosses. and they get a share of the pie in proportion to their contribution. We can use these things. That's one of the mechanisms that I referred to, that at present tends to pump wealth to the wealthy. Banks and money are big topics, and my time's running a bit short. At present, banks tend to generate a lot of debt. They create money in the course of making a loan. That's why economists don't seem to understand that. They think if a bank makes a loan, they're loaning somebody's savings, but they're not. They're creating new money. And then they charge interest on it, but it didn't cost them anything to create the money. Now, they have a right to charge for the service of providing the medium of exchange, but interest rate is not a good way to do that. Worse than that, their incentive is to increase the amount of debt because that's where their main profit is, from making loans. So we need to reform banks so that their business is to provide a service, and they're in such a strategic part of our society. Things like police, courts, army, you know, we don't just let them run loose. we need to say this is what you do, and you don't just spray loans everywhere, because that's how you generate a more instability. And here's a curious thing. Why, if somebody's investment goes bad, why should that hurt the rest of the economy? I'm not sure I've had anybody ask this question. If you build a factory, it makes widgets, nobody wants the widgets, you go broke. You lose your money. If you had investors, they lose theirs. End of story. That one didn't work out. The rest of the economy carries on. But that's not the way it works. If too many businesses go bad at once, the whole economy contracts and we have a recession. If Wall Street crashes, Main Street comes down with it and we have a depression. Why? It's because the money is supplied through loans. And if the loans go bad, the money supply shrinks. And there's not enough money to keep the economy ticking over the way it wants to. There's plenty of people wanting to do stuff. There's plenty of things needing to be done, but there's not the money. Economists say there's a liquidity trap. That's one reason. The money gets stuck in savings or whatever. We could supply money independently of making loans. In fact, I think we should, because loaning new money is like borrowing from the future, which is from our children. Why not save our savings, our resources, our accumulated wealth from the past, convert that into a new form? I think that's the essence of investment. Taking accumulated wealth and using it to develop something new. There's a myth that that's what capitalism is, but that's not what capitalism's been doing much at all for a long time. But I think that is what we need to do. And that's not borrowing, that's using savings. Now, this is anathema. You can't say it. That's crazy. But the effect would be, if we used savings for investment, as economists foolishly imagine that we do in their computer models, if we use savings for investment and we supply currency, the medium of exchange, independently, say you had like a credit and debit card combined, as you have need for cash, you withdraw some, you're marked with a debit in the bank. As you earn money, you can pay it back, your debit's cancelled. We know how to do that. Yes, there was a loan there in a sense. All money is a debt. My $50 bill is my claim on this society. It says, this society owes me $50 worth of goods or services, because this $50 bill is just a piece of paper. I can't eat it. I can't do anything. I can't make something. I can't hammer a nail. It's a token. And it's actually a social agreement, implicitly. And the agreement is, my society owes me $50 worth of goods or services. So there is a debt implicit in money. So we need it. Debt can be a good thing, but debt is fire, and you've got to be careful about playing with it. And I think we generate so much that we generate conflagrations. We need to minimise debt and use it wisely. And there are ways we can do that, and that may be one of the most important ways in which we could stabilise our economy and assure a future. So let me just very briefly go back to how I started. What's the prospect for reformed, transformed economies, economics in creating Australia's future? We could get markets to work properly. So, for example, they all pay the full cost of production. We can guide markets using incentives and disincentives. We can stabilise economies so that we can more sensibly and wisely do what we do and invest. We can extend democracy to the workplace through employee ownership and such things, and to the whole economy by taking charge of it and subordinating it to serving the society we want to have. And there are clever people who are figuring out we can use far fewer of the Earth's resources and we can recycle a lot of them, and it's not terribly expensive. In fact, there can be savings. And so there are good prospects for us returning our systems and ourselves to being part of the biosphere instead of dominating it and trashing it. So I think all that awaits. I don't believe it's going to happen tomorrow, but you've got to get these ideas formulated and out if they're ever going to happen. And I'm happy to debate sensibly, how to do this, or whether all of the things I've said might be right. But I think we can have this kind of aspiration. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you. Can I? Oh, yeah.